Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journeys.
If we're looking at not just where we are now, which I had mentioned we're in the middle of the sixth extinction, but where we are going, right? The projections are something around 9 to 9.6 billion people on the planet by 2050. And we see billions of people emerging into middle class, particularly in places like Uganda, Nigeria, and India, and China. And those individuals will want to eat more protein and drink more milk and want air conditioning and drive cars within their lives. And what that means is at least a 70% increase in food production and an increase in land area that's equal to the size of the United States. What we have seen is the scale of this problem is exponential, right? Population growth is an exponential problem, and our solutions have tended to be linear. So how do we actually increase the speed and scale and efficacy of those solutions? Well, the one area where we have been doing that has been in technology, coupled with the connectivity that we have worldwide. Those two particular tools, how do we harness them to find new solutions?
I'm very pleased today to introduce Alex Deegan. Alex is the CEO and co-founder of Conservation X Labs, a startup for tech innovation for conservation and development. Prior to founding Conservation X Labs, Alex served as the chief scientist at USAID and founded the Global Development Lab. Conservation X Labs aims to harness exponential technologies, open innovation, and entrepreneurship to dramatically improve the efficacy, scale, and sustainability of conservation efforts to end human-induced extinction. Well, thank you very much, Alex, for taking the time today to join me and on Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs. I'm very much looking forward to talking to you, finding out what you're up to in Conservation X Labs, the work that you're doing, and what you hope to achieve in the future.
Yeah, so maybe I could just start off and tell you a little bit about what we're doing and who we are.
Brilliant.
That sound okay as an introduction?
Absolutely.
So Conservation X Labs really came because of my experience working with as chief scientist of the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is the world's largest bilateral development agency. And we built what was called a DARPA for development, which was a recognition that we needed to completely rethink how we were solving development problems. And as I was looking at fields like global health and food security, which had adopted things like open innovation, adopted things like advanced technology, and just the evolution of those fields, global health itself had started from a field called tropical medicine, which was all physicians, frequently all male, and who had essentially said, I understand what all the problems are, and I understand what all the solutions are. And the fact is, they didn't. And we saw this evolution from tropical medicine to global health that evolved, where you saw many more disciplines coming into the field of anthropologists and economists and engineers were just as likely to be global health experts. And after I left USAID, after we launched this DARPA for development, the Global Development Lab, I realized that conservation had perhaps an even bigger problem than development did. If you think about it, conservationists are kind of the worst people to actually invite to dinner. We're perhaps the most depressing people to have at your dinner table. We've invented a field whose entire job is to document and lament the passing of species. And in the 30 years that the Society of Conservation Biology, which is the flagship academic society, was created, and it's been about 30 something years since we even coined the word biodiversity, we haven't seen the successes that we've needed. We've been exponentially successful building things like national parks around the world, but in fact, we're still in the middle of a sixth extinction. those extinctions are at 1,000 times background extinction rates and are probably underestimated by a factor of 10, because the very animals that we tend to study have a bias towards those animals that are widely dispersed, easy to detect, wide-ranging for a number of reasons, which means that they're actually much more resilient to withstand the forces, both random and directed, of the extinction process. So I wanted to take what I had learned from what we had done in international development, which was launch grand challenges, think about how we use what was called exponential technologies, and think about how we use entrepreneurship and apply it to the conservation field. And so I started in two ways. One was in my role at Duke University, to really think about creating a new discipline of conservation innovation and conservation engineering, and reorient conservation from a single disciplinary field, or even a limited field of, you know, mainly biologists, but a few economists and a few others, social scientists, moving into a field, to truly a multidisciplinary field that was much more similar to a discipline of engineering than it was a discipline of biology. The second thing was to set up a company that would help with creating the ecosystem to be able to bring new technologies that would help us improve the speed, efficacy, scale, and sustainability of conservation efforts, just because we had generally 10% of the money we needed at any one point to solve any of these problems. And we needed to fundamentally rethink the ways that we were going about solving them. We needed to broaden the disciplines of individuals involved, and we needed to bring in entire new solutions and new solvers to how we would actually do it. And we needed new sources of income. So on those ideas, Conservation X Labs was set up.
Right. That's fascinating. It's very interesting you talk about the multidisciplinary approach, because that's something in recent interviews that has been highlighted. And the nature of some of these problems are so complex and so interconnected that any siloed approaches or approaches from one particular perspective or frame of mind are inevitably limited. And the challenges do need this interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary approach. I'm wondering about the role that you ascribe to technology, or the focus you have on technology. I can see how a multidisciplinary approach can, offer many, many benefits. Why is it necessary to have technology? What was your analysis of the problem or of the challenge in the way conservationists were working that suggested that technology was the solution?
Well, I think it is recognizing that technology is necessary but not sufficient to actually solve these problems. So that's just kind of the first statement. And it was just a missing that conservation has actually tended to be technophobic. And I want to get into some really specific examples and how we're thinking about that, because I think that makes it more concrete for understanding the subject. But I want to go back to just one comment on the multidisciplinary thing. I think we're at a period of time where the experts are fully able to help us understand the actual problems, but in no way are in charge of all the solutions. And in fact, for a long time in conservation, we've asked biologists to do things like ecotourism. And it just made sense, right? You're building a national park. Well, you should set up tourism operations. You know, what does a biologist, right, which are those at the parties that like to sit there and look at their shoes rather than engage, actually understand about marketing, business, the ability of running a hospitality industry, which is its own specialization, right? Or what does it understand about the use of sensors or machine vision or some of the emerging fields of biology and what impacts those have? And that's kind of the reason, is that there's an incredible set of new innovations that are out there. And this gets back to the technology question, and that there's been this vast, what I call a democratization of science and technology, the accessibility of technology, the power that is in something like an iPhone. It isn't a communications device. It is a sensor. It is an education tool. It is a way of doing financial transactions and incentivizing people. And it is a way of scaling up every aspect of what we need in conservation. And that gets to kind of why technology, it is, because I think if we're looking at not just where we are now, which I had mentioned we're in the middle of the sixth extinction, but where we are going, right? The projections are something around 9 to 9.6 billion people on the planet by 2050. And we see billions of people emerging into middle class, particularly in places like Uganda and Nigeria and India and China. And those individuals will want to eat more protein and drink more milk and want air conditioning and drive cars within their lives. And what that means is at least a 70% increase in food production and an increase in land area that's equal to the size of the United States. It also means doubling the amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, the amount of pesticides we would potentially use, the amount of water that we are using around the world. And where is there land equal to the size of the United States? Well, it's the Congo Basin, it's the Amazon Basin, and that really makes me think we need to come up with solutions that no longer just deal with the systems of conservation. How do we actually create these islands for the preservation of biodiversity and try to set those apart? But how do we actually get at the underlying drivers, which is reinventing protein sources, which is thinking about engineering resilience for the changes we already know that will come no matter what we do on climate change for the next 100 years, which is restoring 20% of the planet's Earth that is highly degraded. And what we have seen is the scale of this problem is exponential, right? Population growth is an exponential problem. And our solutions have tended to be linear. So how do we actually increase the speed and scale and efficacy of those solutions? Well, the one area where we have been doing that has been in technology coupled with the connectivity that we have worldwide. Those two particular tools, how do we harness them to find new solutions? That still requires design, that still requires understanding the problem, it still requires understanding and designing for the ecosystem that you are working in, just as Apple is designing iPhones for the consumers it sees as its main client.
Right. Very interesting. That's very interesting. Now, you mentioned that I think in a recent interview, you talked about some powerful new tools for conservation. So I suppose that that would be interesting to get your sense of what some of these technologies are that maybe haven't been applied to conservation and maybe talk a little bit about those and what potential you see there.
Yeah. So, I'll start with things that we are working on. So we recently ran a global challenge, an open innovation competition around, how do we rethink one of these underlying drivers? And so we actually decided to say, if we're thinking about what are the grand challenges in the oceans, what are the potential, what are the major problems and how do we solve them? And what's the first problem we should hit? And we actually chose aquaculture. And aquaculture is important because 50% of the world's fish is now farmed. Something like half the Earth's population is within 60 to 70 kilometers of a coastline. And so as we have this increased demand for protein, it's clear that we need to look toward the oceans to provide it. But the way we grow fish, the way we farm fish, is we actually capture wild fish and what we call trash fish and feed it to grow fish. And the way we do that involves, horrible environmental practices. It involves, sometimes slavery. It involves, essential damage that cannot be undone to our systems. So it is not a sustainable way for food security in the ways and the pathways that we have now. So we've been really thinking about how do we actually come up with novel ways to replace the protein within fish meal, which is what is used to feed fish in aquaculture. And how do we do it in a way and how do we actually reinvent the whole aquaculture systems and come up with new products from the oceans? And some of the solutions are, looking at fungus, looking at bacteria to actually produce protein, capturing carbon dioxide that comes out of smokestacks and turning it into a protein source so we actually get a climate benefit, growing algae and growing insects, such as black soldier fly, which have the impact of actually using black soldier fly to either grow them off of agricultural waste or grow them off of sewage or other types of waste. So you literally are having a simultaneous benefit to reducing waste and producing protein sources that go into fish production simultaneously. With algae, it's even better because algae is an amazing, fast-growing, super efficient source of protein. But it has this additional benefit that if you actually start feeding algae as part of the protein sources on terrestrial feeds, such as to cows, you can get the cows to produce less methane, and cows are a major source of carbon dioxide. That's kind of a really simple but boring set of innovations that I think could be profoundly transformative in meeting, you know, an unbelievable percentage of this planet's protein supply.
Right.
50% of the planet that actually lives near the oceans. But I think that there's even more exciting ideas. Much as people brew beer, there's a company called Perfect Day that has figured out how to brew milk. And the milk is chemically indistinguishable from milk that is produced by cows. So it's not... it's not something like soy, which is, you know, results in deforestation, or almond milk, which isn't a driver of deforestation, but has this additional problem of being highly water dependent. So almonds are heavily grown in California, which is in the middle of the drought. It is actually produced without a cow, but it is milk, and it has a couple of advantages. You don't have the animal. You don't have the animal welfare situation that you do with cows. You don't have the deforestation that goes and land clearance that goes with the production of cows. You don't have the methane production that cows have, which are major drivers of environmental change, right? But people are a little bit freaked out. They're like, well, you're brewing milk. Well, we've been brewing beer for a few thousand years, starting off in Egypt. You know, this is tweaking the same products to actually brew milk in novel ways. And there's a whole set of what are called cellular meats that are being produced. And another example is New Wave Foods, which is looking at growing algae to actually produce shrimp. It's a substitute for shrimp that no longer needs shrimp ponds, which produce huge amounts of pollution, environmental degradation that's associated with shrimp, and then, of course, the slavery issues that have been associated with shrimp production. All of those are skipped. And you also have something that's now vegan and kosher for,
yes,
for individuals around,
yes,
the world.
Yes.
With a much more sustainable footprint. And this is kind of what I mean.
Right.
I think I'll stop there, but there's,
yes,
there's,
yeah,
a lot of other technologies that are out there. But those,
right,
are some of them.
No, they're fascinating. It sounds really interesting, these ideas you're talking about. I guess I'd be interested in understanding, because presumably in labs all around the world, there are some, you know, fascinating, exciting, and maybe even science fiction, what looked like science fiction approaches to, you know, some of these questions you're talking about. And they may well, and many of them, some of them will turn out to be effective. What is your model for a diffusion of innovation and reaching scale? Because, you know, somebody might have come up with this great breakthrough, but how do you look at this question of getting it to the places that would absolutely need it?
So this is a great question. I think the first part of it is, and this is really, I think, the areas that we are deeply interested in, is how do you build the innovation pipelines? The one issue you have with universities is they're based on this thousand-year-old system that is really ineffective at translating knowledge and service to society. And even in the United States, there's really a few places that do it well, and they don't do it efficiently. It's places like Stanford and MIT that I think are leaders in thinking about how you translate the knowledge. And this is despite the fact that in the United States, most research is supported by the American taxpayer. So the first idea is, how do we partner with universities to really be able to identify the innovations we need? And then how do we actually find others who have great ideas, but don't have necessarily the opportunity? And that's where prizes and challenges come in. That is where partnerships with universities come in. That's where our own research comes in. The second is really moving from those great ideas and that great research to an innovation or a prototype. And that really comes to, do we understand what the problem is? Do we actually understand the insights into the demand? And how do we build scale, the scalability of the product in from the beginning? Conservation is super effective at creating pilots, just like development has been. But a set of pilots, if it doesn't go to scale, doesn't have an effect. If you reach 1 million people in India, which sounds like a lot, it is still a thousandth of the population of the country. And it's a question of whether that 1 million people would even count as scale. And it depends on really the problem you have. Then is really this question of, as you have a prototype, to be able to do the testing, to be able to do the consumer interviews, to develop the minimum viable product and continue to iterate on its design. And then there's this question of how do you move from innovation to enterprise? And that's really all of the elements of what's the business case for what you're trying to do. And this is where we're trying to build one of the first conservation technology accelerators, along with an investment fund, to be able to take some of these ideas, particularly where there might be, where there's either direct demand for the product, and that's where all the design elements come in, or there's secondary markets outside of conservation that would help scale the actual product. And this is, or there's a company that actually wants to acquire the technology to transform how they do their own business.
Right, right.
This is what we're trying to do, is how do we source, develop, and scale the products that could fundamentally transform these underlying drivers of extinction.
Right, right. And where are you on that journey? Because this is I won't say an old chestnut, but it's something that's it's around. It's very ever present. This question of really scaling successful and powerful innovations in the social sector.
Yeah. So we're actually in the middle of two things. One is we're actually writing a piece, a paper on scaling and conservation, because we don't believe conservation has been successful in scaling. If you look at international development, there's really a small handful of global successes. And those are things like, we've been able to eliminate smallpox and rinderpest off the face of the earth. So those things have scaled. Oral rehydration salts, it's taken us 50 years to scale, really simple innovation to deal with diarrheal diseases, which millions of children die from. We've got guinea worm and we've got polio that are on the brink of scale of being eliminated off the course of the planet. Guinea worm probably will. Polio, it's limited actually by behavioral and cultural factors in Nigeria, in Pakistan, and in Afghanistan, and I think we're close on those cases. But the number of solutions we have, things like vaccines, are somewhat limited, and the examples out there are somewhat limited, and they take entire systems to be able to do. In our case, we're about to launch in partnership with other conservation organizations, because we can't, our job is, we want to disrupt the conservation sector, but we want to disrupt it by doing it with the conservation organizations and helping them transform how they're actually solving these problems. And we rely on the global reach of those organizations, of national governments and of others, to test support, to help us with the policy frameworks that help these things scale. But right now, particularly given the election in the United States, it is unlikely that our government here will be the solution to how we get these ideas to scale, and that we actually need private sector investments to be able to change the very choices available to consumers, to change the very tools that we have available to solve these problems, and to deeply automate, accelerate, and address the underlying drivers of extinction.
Right, very interesting. Now, you mentioned this word, which we hear a lot of, particularly in Silicon Valley, but it seems to be everywhere now, disruption. And I want to get your views on disruption because, you know, by and large, when you see investors talking about it, technologists talking about it, it seems to be this amazing thing that disintermediates, that offers more efficient ways of doing things and promises. And yet there are, you know, huge side effects in many cases. There are, you know, social systems that are disrupted and, you know, who benefits from these disruptions? And I'm just wondering about some of the side effects of disruption and, you know, these sometimes systems, you know, build over time and they are, you know, complex and interconnected. And, you know, some piece of technology, you know, sweeps into the arena and, you know, and everything changes. And, you know, is there not a real danger of unintended consequences?
Yeah, so there's two thoughts. You know, one, conservationists have been disrupting things from the beginning. The first national park involves pretty substantial, and every national park we build around the world, people live in those areas. It's very rarely that you build a park that doesn't have an incredibly disruptive ability for the residents and the communities that are there, both good and bad. So this idea, I don't think the idea of disruption in conservation is something that's necessarily new. I think the other thing is just to recognize that we have policy choices that we need to make globally. And I'll give you one example from development, just given I've worked in development and conservation, and there's some really great choices there, is small-scale farms. So we spend an enormous amount of money in international development supporting small-scale farmers. But small-scale farmers actually don't have the ability to increase food production efficiently. And the tendency is they actually, shifting agriculture is a main driver of deforestation that's out there. In Madagascar, a place I spent many years working, it is a significant driver of deforestation, you know, contributing to 90% of the loss of forests on that island. But our small-scale farmers are also super unresilient to climate change. They don't have the ability to use and integrate advanced technologies and seeds, which have the ability to dramatically increase productivity for them. So if we're thinking about the larger global environment, it isn't supporting small-scale farmers, it isn't investing in small-scale farmers. And in fact, what we tend to do is we actually reinforce poverty by investing in small-scale farmers. Why do we actually invest in small-scale farmers? It is entirely a political calculation that is intended because we don't want people moving in masses to the cities where they may not be jobs for them, and it results in social unrest. So it's a great question, right? It's a choice we're making, and that choice has ethical quandaries in both ways, right? If people are forced to move to the cities, then there needs to be a set of livelihoods for those people in the cities. If people stay on these small-scale farms, they actually contribute and continue environmental degradation, are unresilient in the face of climate change, and also that we essentially are keeping them and their children and their children's children in poverty. And it's an ethical question. I think that you can look similarly at some of the technology that we're doing with thinking about, you know, there's advances in understanding genetics, particularly our ability to use and edit the genome, much as you can edit a Microsoft Word document, the letters of a Microsoft Word document. Now, this is where new tools like CRISPR-Cas9 have gotten us. And many people are, you know, scared of what the implications of this technology are, and there definitely needs to be an ethical framework. But this is the question. We can take something like a heat shock protein and increase the ability of a coral reef symbiote to withstand ocean warming. So the question is, do we not use this technology to address ocean warming
a much tougher question is ocean acidification, and we lose the entire coral reef of the Maldives or the rest of the coral reefs that hasn't been lost of Australia or Belize, or do we help actually use these advanced technologies with imperfect knowledge and try to find a solution that would actually allow us to protect those coral reefs? What is the more evil choice? The loss of all the coral reefs, or a particular technology that is new and we are unsure of those unintended consequences? And I think this is where concepts like the precautionary principle actually don't work. And we have real challenges with thinking about what the future of these technologies are for what we're trying to do. I think most of cases when people think of unintended consequences, they're thinking of driverless cars and what it means that we're putting all the truck drivers out of business. Well, I mean, we used to have textile plants and many of those textile plants don't exist in the United States. It's unlikely we will get those textile jobs back, or we want those jobs back, because the technology has taken those things that are time consuming, that require huge amounts of data and covering large amounts of area, and allows us to accelerate it. And we now have the ability to eliminate that. That's also applicable to how we can protect our forests, how we understand the spread of invasive diseases and invasive species, which are driving many species extinct. And again, there is a larger ethical and social framework that has to give license to these kinds of approaches. But a lot of times we're not using evidence to make those decisions.
Right. Very interesting. Covered a lot of ground there. Now tell me a little bit about the scale of your operation, where you are today and where your vision, where you want to be in the next 5 years, Alex.
Yeah, so we've only been around for a year and a half. We are small, although we have put on this with the Australian government and a couple of other partners, including WWF and an innovation group called Second Muse, a global challenge around rethinking aquaculture. We just awarded the winners of that challenge at Secretary Kerry's Our Oceans event. We also have, we're about to launch the accelerator and bring in the first cohort classes focused on ocean food and new foods for the oceans, as well as new feeds for the oceans. We're looking at expanding into other areas such as wildlife trafficking, plastics, thinking about other areas of food, thinking about invasive species. And we also build technology. Two things that are under development have been this handheld portable DNA, what's called a barcode scanner. So the idea that we aren't developing DNA technologies for a really pristine lab, but you're building it for a customs warehouse in Zambia or the end of a pier in Palau. And those are some of the things that we have underway. I think in 5 years, the idea is literally to be the Bell Labs or Google of conservation technology, where we not only are building technologies ourselves, but we're actually unlocking innovation and transforming the entire field and bringing together a tribe of new conservation engineers and conservation anthropologists, conservation economists, conservation marketers that are all helping us find new solutions. And one other thing that we're about to launch in early 2017, probably at this conference called Earth Optimism, which is about, you know, changing that depressive tone in conservation that I talked about at the beginning of this podcast, is one of the first open source hardware platforms for building conservation technology, that if people have a really good idea, they can come to the platform, bring a community and join a community of engineers, of designers, of economists, of behavioralists, behavioral economic experts, and help develop new technologies that we can help take to scale. And if they are successful, put it to the accelerator and get funded.
Great. Great. What have been the challenges for you on this journey, and what are some of the challenges? Are you a social entrepreneur? Do you see that it's a very loose term, means different things, but do you see yourself as a social entrepreneur, and what are some of the biggest challenges you've had so far, Alex?
There's a few. I definitely think I'm a social entrepreneur, but I've seen variations of the use of the term. You know, one sense is social entrepreneurship is using the tools of business, but is not necessarily, has mainly a social, their currency is the mission rather than necessarily a profit. I actually believe deeply into the double bottom line, that without some sort of both, we're interested in both the economic sustainability and scalability of the product as much as we are of the ecological sustainability of what we're trying to do. And so in that sense, we're ultimately still just entrepreneurs, I think, in our activities. But the challenge for me has been, I really want our organization, and I turned down amazing opportunities to join it, to have global impact, to really be at a scale that matches the size of the problems that we have. And the only way really to do that, if you are not an international organization, is by leveraging the power of others, of recognizing that talent is everywhere, but opportunity is not. And we really want to be in that business of providing opportunities to others. So I think that's the second sort of, I think the challenge of making sure that whatever we're doing is actually financially sustainable is one. I think making sure that we actually hit the scale that makes what we do relevant is the second. And then I think the third challenge is conservation. So I've met many awesome people within the conservation movement that are really excited about what we do. But, at least in terms of where the investment and funding is, we've got this challenge that traditional conservation funders are still doing the same thing and expecting different results, and are highly conservative, and in fact are holding back the actual field from the innovations that need to happen. And I think that this really goes, they feel that, well, we can't take risks, but they're actually taking greater risks by keep doing the same things and hoping that things will change without the evidence basis for that change. I think the other side of the equation is the investment markets haven't recognized that there is a market for social entrepreneurship that is, highly lucrative, particularly given that global interest rates are at the lowest they've almost ever been, that there is opportunities for returns, and those returns can actually help us chart entire new pathways to industrialization that mean countries don't have to follow the pathways that we've taken, that our ability to feed increasing populations can do so in a way that are fundamentally greener. And I think that there's great opportunities for investment there, but we're in the middle between those two places, and that's also been a little bit difficult.
Great. To hear your that was the wrong thing to say. Let me just note that down the time. What time were we on our call at all? It's hard to do the
57.
It's 57. Yes. So what I meant to say, and let me get that again, is that sounds very interesting. And inevitably, doing being innovative and creating change is challenging. And I wish you the very best of success with that, Alex. So thank you very much for taking the time to speak to Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs today, and good luck with your continuing work.
I thank you very much. I just want to say, I think whether you're an entrepreneur, an intrapreneur, or an extrapreneur, where you're influencing other organizations, I think you're in the right place at the right time to actually have impact around the world. And so I hope everyone else joins us in, there's a lot of room to bring great change. So thank you for the opportunity to chat.
Best of luck. Thank you.
Cheers.
I realized there was a question I should have asked earlier, and I'm going to cut that back in. Have you got a moment?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. One is, I'll just ask you about it in a second, is the question of incentives. And to what extent, Alex, are you concerned about incentives and how they operate in the world of conservation?
So this is a great question. So the one thing that's really clear is that if you look at behavioral economics research, people will not act because it's always the right thing to do for merely the moral good. Otherwise, we have far better gains at things like climate change. They also have this issue that they see the problem as too big and too diffuse for them and their individual actions, even though collectively they could have enormous impact to transform what they're trying to do. So this question of actually human behavior, which is tied to marketing, which is tied to identity, is critical and is actually part of the design process in everything that we are building. So what is it that would, you know, what are the pain points that people have? What are the barriers or the constraints of preventing people from acting in a way that allows them to take up a new product, to take up a new solution, or stop doing an action? And so there's different ways of doing this. With consumer products, it's finding replacements. And in some cases, it's actually eliminating the choices that lead to environmental unsustainable practices. Palm oil would be one example in terms of what you're trying to do. It's where there are incentives to get people to act. And there's a great example, which we probably don't have time to go into, but it's called Recycle Bank, where they found a really novel way of incentivizing people through points that can be used for Starbucks cards to recycle. The thing that they got the cities to recognize to put up the funding was that they were spending the money anyway because they were sending more garbage trucks to the landfill. If they could reduce that, there was actually a pool of money that could then be used to increase recycling levels, and that led to a whole bunch of other value chain considerations. In terms of what we're trying to build in terms of bringing in new solvers and new solutions into the conservation space, so bringing in engineers and anthropologists, this is actually this question of how do you build a community, how do you keep that community sticky, how do you keep it engaged, and how do you create, not just through financial incentives for cooperation to happen, but for other ones like identity, competition, gamification, how do we use those as fundamental tools in our behavior to increase our leverage, increase our opportunity, and to get to the types of solutions that will match the speed and the scale of the problem. So I think incentives are critical in so many different ways. It's a great question to ask.
Right. It's interesting because you mentioned this question of financial incentives. And I know from speaking to people active in conservation that they discover that working with local communities who have a real commitment to the to the local environment, that they find that they actually have quite long-term thinking. And you'd imagine when they sit down to look at some of these challenges that they would be also trying to, focus on the making money as well, but that taking a very long-term perspective, and the surprising result. And I'm just wondering, sometimes while social entrepreneurs and the pursuit of profit and certainly driving more sustainable organizations that can do their own work without looking for funding the whole time is very important. Do you see any danger of over-reliance on financial incentives, financialization? And you do hear people talking about this, financialization and commodification. And once you introduce the profit principle into many kinds of social systems, they are changed and not always for the better.
Yeah, so I think the one thing that's important to distinguish is between products and programs. So programs, I think, that's probably definitely true. And in fact, this is what I'm talking about incentives. When I talk about identity, people are actually much more, people may see themselves as environmentally green. And if you give them opportunities to act on and reinforce that identity, that is actually a powerful incentive itself. Fear is another incentive. Competition is another incentive. There's a great example of a small street in the UK called Tidy Street, where they put energy use and they painted it on per house on the road in front of each house, which actually reduced the ability that people had to address their problems. In terms of programs, I think you're right that communities can actually make good decisions. It depends on a lot of things being right, right? So one of them is land tenure and ownership and control. The second is actually controlling for things like the prisoner's dilemma in game theory, where individual saboteurs can actually defeat that entire system if one person chooses to monetize. It's how you're structuring those programs. But one example, you know, we tend to spend huge amounts of money in conservation without necessarily a guarantee that we're going to get results. And there are new ways of people, prizes and challenges are won, which are pay for performance mechanisms. There's something else called advanced market commitments, which governments agree to buy X numbers of products, such as a vaccine, if the manufacturers actually produce that product. So they literally are creating a market for it. And ways of using pay for performance, I think, can be really powerful even on a local level. This is just a personal story, but when I was in Madagascar, I worked in a set of habitat fragments across many years, and it took a number of years to actually get enough data to understand these underlying drivers of extinction and trying to create a model to predict extinction among lemurs in Madagascar. So I needed these fragments, which were in unprotected forest, to be there across a couple of years. So I figured out what people actually pay for the charcoal after they burn down the rainforest and what they get from a year of growing rice, and paid villages 50% of that amount up front and promised them 50% at the end based on the valuation that they would have gotten from the forest if they would protect the forest for that year. Not only did they protect the forest, the trails had overgrown, but they actually made very smart decisions as to what to do with the money, which I hadn't given them any input on. Some had grown fast-growing trees, other had grown fruit trees, which are far more sustainable and increased incomes for those villages. It wasn't my intent to do that experiment. It was my intent to try to finish a PhD. But I found that really interesting in a place where USAID had poured millions of dollars but hadn't really seen the effectiveness of those investments. It was a really small amount of money. It was probably $1 or $2 a hectare, which was what value they were getting off of those investments, $2 to $3 a hectare. But it was a really simple incentive that was a recognition of ownership of those villages and the provision of alternatives. The fact is, people will still always need to eat. They'll still need to feed their families, and they still have underlying desires for what to do. And when they don't have those alternatives, you can have all the long-term goals that you want, but they're very hard to put in place if you're not, you know, if you don't have an alternative.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.